The session is titled How Business Should Operate in Conflict Zones. And we've heard from different conceptual perspectives. We've toured a few case studies. We've looked at some recommendations and challenges. And I think the consensus is yes, business does have a role, but I think the vexing question that we're still trying to tease out is how do we do this in a way that doesn't undermine human rights? Now, we've seen some examples, but we know that the vast majority of the cases that we deal with do not adhere to all of the noble principles that, and good practice that we have discussed in the panel. I'd like to open it for questions. Please introduce yourself, and if you make your question as concise as possible, that would help. We'll take the questions in sets of four.
Hi, my name is Ted Carroll, and I work with the World Justice Project, and I'm also a graduate student here at GW. I have a question about youth in conflict zones, specifically. We see frequently that in many places in Africa, and in the Middle East, and Central America, for example, that underengaged youth are at the core of a lot of conflict. So I'm wondering if there are any models or best practices that any of you could briefly discuss regarding how businesses can engage youth, whether it's through skills, training and development, or sort of youth-focused infrastructure. Any discussion on those would be great. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, I think we have the gentleman over here.
Thank you. My name is Tavio. I'm from Global Rights. And the consensus seemed to be on the panel that absolutely it's going to work in conflict zones. Although you talk about a conflict inherently, that in all conflicts are different everywhere in the world, but it kind of signifies that there's a breakdown of the state and a breakdown of rule of law. And then it's not necessarily a lack of certainty about who's actually representing the people in the area where you work. And then if you're going to come in and, particularly the two examples are from, extraction, which inherently has an impact on the surrounding environment. If you're talking about mining or hydrocarbon extraction. And then, and kind of the cases I'm familiar with in places like Colombia, the Chiquita Bananas case is high profile, where companies had to have security because you have a large interest in that area. And then who do you provide the security to? In the case of Chiquita, they're paying the FARC, the insurgents. Then they're paying off the paramilitaries. And there's a lack of state presence. So I don't think it's as simple as yes, absolutely, or in the case of Liberia, that example is post-conflict. But how do you deal with security? How do you deal when there is no state and still say, well, we're independent, we're a business, we don't want to get, I don't know if we can enforce human rights practices. And I just want to leave that question open for the panel.
Thank you. Yes, the lady right there. Do we have a fourth for this round? Okay, then we'll take the three. We'll take the three questions.
Hi, Kendall Salcido from Nomogaya. This question is mostly for Olaf and Charlotte. You both work in places that are post-conflict, and sort of inherent in post-conflict is post-divide. You've got social divisions that come along ethnic lines or religious lines, sometimes gender lines. And I've seen often in my experience that that's reflected in the workforce, that HR managers hire people of their tribe, of their religion, of their caste, which is inherently discriminatory regardless of your discrimination policies. I wonder if either of you in your experiences have tried to address sort of inherent discrimination that comes with operating in these places, and if so, how you've dealt with that. Thanks.
Okay, we'll go down the panel. I'm asking for their responses to these three points. But I think I'd just like to reinforce and probably try to summarize the three questions. The first speaks to the heart of what is a conflict zone. My take is there is no such thing as post-conflict. Even after the major hostilities have ended, you still have low-intensity conflict over a protracted period, and most of the key issues are still unresolved. And so a lot of the challenges still exist. But in that context, when there is no rule of law, the political economy has been subverted. Exactly how do you ensure that a lot of the well-intentioned interventions are actually impactful? And how do you ensure that your business activity does not either disadvantage groups or enable spoilers? Which brings me to the first question from Ted on youth. The youth are usually part of the disadvantaged and aggrieved 99%, so to speak. So how do you, how does your activity take this into consideration, and how do you have policies or mechanisms to engage with them? Let's start from you, Wallet, and if you can be as concise as possible, so we'll have a second round of questions. Thank you.
Okay. I should be concise, and let me answer you asked one question, if I have ever experienced tribal favoritism. I have, and I have seen quite a bit of that. Sometimes, as a company, we are usually basing our business on the local staff. And having lived in Nigeria, we have about 25,000 working for Shell in there, and about 300 expats. And I think one of the good things that expats can bring with them is to see through a bit of these things and even use it for a moving week. And I've seen it in the team I took over that previously was led by a Nigerian. I've seen it by the human resources. I've seen it all around the place. And I've seen it more in local companies than I see it in international companies. But I'm not saying that international companies is the solution either. But I've seen it inside Shell. And it's something we are addressing straight away. Because we want to have a diverse workforce that's representing representing the company basically, and also representing the country where you operate. And this has been a challenge, not only that, but also how you start engaging in communities and how you're giving out money into the communities. And what I can see out of the 15,000 scholarships we give out every year, it was one of the things I was really looking at. Are there reasons to look at certain allocations? And it was. So it's existing. And it's much stronger than it is in, for example, in a society like the United States. And it's usually stronger than what you see in Europe. But it has reasons, and it's history, and it's a challenge. But point is, it's a challenge, and we need to manage it. On the security side, just to comment on that, I think you are diving straight into the area where we work on the voluntary principles for security and human rights. It's one of the areas we are working quite active as the extractive industries. And basically, I would say we are trying to address exactly the points you're raising. What sort of security are we calling for? What sort of security are we using? And it's different from country to country, and it's different national rules, but it's also naturally different operations where we use security. But we are using security in almost everywhere where we operate. Different types. In the US, we're using private security companies to guard our facilities. So sometimes you have to go back home and think, what securities are you using? And the first you go into an office in DC, usually there's a person sitting at the reception. We call that security as well. But for the wider conflict area, when you ask for military or armed security, there are a set of engagements that's advised under the voluntary principles for human rights. I think that's maybe a little bit simple answer, but it's at least the direction where we are working. On the youth side, I will be short, I will not take all your time. The most interesting thing I've been working on the youth side has been the amnesty that was given by the Nigerian government to all the militants groups that operated in Nigeria from about 2005 to 2009 with attacking operations. And we've been involved with the government to try to rehabilitate the young people that's been involved in this. And that's been a huge challenge, and it's not easy, because their mindset is based on the work and activities they had in their militia groups, and getting them back to the normal society and getting them back to society has been a tough one. And it's not there yet, far away there, but it's an interesting area. Generally working on youth and employment is to create jobs. Create jobs is what we are good at. Create training and get jobs, and that's exactly where business have a major contribution to any societies where we are working.
So I think all very relevant questions. I wish I had answers. Maybe you have some answers. With regards to youth, youth is a big, big worry. When Cote d'Ivoire really had the big issues earlier this year, I had daily conversations with our security in Liberia because we didn't want the youth, the former child soldiers, to hop across the border and join these military groups. So one plan we had was to just employ them doing whatever. You know, like cutting grass somewhere in the bush or something, because it's just about money. You know, there's the groups around across the border pay more than we would, you know, so we had plans in place like that, but actually the situation calmed down and it's not quite there yet, but that was one of the ideas we had. What we had done up in our concession zone by the Guinean border, we inherited a town called Yekabai, north of Liberia. It was supposed to be free of people, but as all my panelists here know, it's never that. So we inherited a community of thousands of squatters. A big group of these squatters, especially in Camp 4, are former child soldiers. They have nowhere to go. They're not welcome back in their own communities because they've probably raped their relatives or killed them through force. So what you do is having these people right on your doorstep with expats and others. One thing we've done is to employ them to cut grass, which is very important in malaria prevention, and managing the snakes. We're right in a tropical forest. There are thousands of snakes around. But it works quite all right up there, but down in the port, it doesn't. The moment we let them into our concession area, they come with their scrapping tools, and they strip the place. I still don't know how we're going to deal with that. Moving on to the how do you employ security. So I'll give you an example again from Liberia. Down at the port, we don't have barbed wire. We only have barbed wire and locks where we keep computers or generators or fuel. But except for that, the community kind of can walk around the premises because we're trying to create social cohesion. Let's see if it's working. It's worked so far, but who knows. So I was speaking to one of our security guards just where we have these former child soldiers, he had loads of scars on him. Because what happens is, at night, these gangs come with his scrapping equipment, and they cut him with their machetes. And he's there, and he calls for security forces to come, the police, but the police takes 15 minutes to come, so by then he would have run away. But this is our approach for the moment. We do not want to arm our security guards. This is not the right moment in Liberia to arm any security guards. How do you do it when the UN military has left? I'm not sure. And finally, on sort of employing people from your own, this is an issue in almost all the countries where we operate. Kazakhstan, South Africa, Bosnia, Liberia. I think the only thing that helps is really to train local talent through your international management education and have quite a lot of sort of training where you experience for yourself kind of these kind of biases. And again, it's really hard to break through when you try to localize your workforce and management. And I think it's a pain for everyone, I'm sure. No good solutions there either, I'm afraid.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You know, I think one reason my friend Olav enjoyed working for Shell in Nigeria is that one is considered a youth in Nigeria until you're about your age or almost even my age now.
Exactly.
Two quick points here. One, responding really to our moderator's distillation of the questions, and that is the evolving definition of conflict zones. And I'd like to sort of refer back to a point both the questioner alluded to and one that I alluded to in my opening comments, and that is that most of the conflict zones that we've been talking about are ones in physical space, particularly with respect to extractives in Nigeria or your company in dealing ArcelorMittal and dealing in a post-Civil War situation in Liberia. There are many, many other examples. But I had mentioned the example of Vodafone getting shut down in Egypt last February, the sort of force majeure situation where people acting on behalf of the then government made it absolutely clear that the network was to shut down immediately and threatened force if that didn't happen. And so I think we're now beginning to see internet and telecommunications companies become actors, however unwilling, in conflict zones. And we're beginning to see conflict zones not only playing out in traditional physical space, as the subject has been defined, but increasingly in cyberspace. And I think that there's a tremendous need for companies to understand both the risks and responsibilities that they face when their networks might get taken over, censored, filtered. The good news is that the Global Network Initiative has been developed in part to address those kinds of issues. The less good news is that it's still early days for that initiative and for most of the industry. The second and final point I'd like to make is one that I think plays off a couple of the questions from the audience, but also from the very final point, Jenny, that you made without elaboration as time is running out, and that is the scope for public policy collaboration. And I just want to point back to the discussions that I missed and heard about this morning around Dodd-Frank 1502, conflict minerals. And I just want to say that, you know, as one who's been involved in this field for a long time, corporate responsibility initiatives, multi-stakeholder initiatives, public-private company NGO partnerships aren't that new anymore. We've seen a number of them, and they're refreshing when we see them. What still is new, in my experience, is to see such a multi-stakeholder coalition come together around an urgent human rights and conflict crisis, as we've been seeing in the DRC, come together to support an affirmative legislative and, yes, regulatory approach as embodied in 1502. And my firm, Calvert, was very proud to be part of that multi-stakeholder coalition, together with other investors, as you so, playing a coordinating role, for example, with NGOs such as Global Witness and Enough, and with major multinational corporations, with GE, HP, Ford Motor Company, AMD, allies every step of the way. And maybe we've had some shades of difference through the SEC comment formulation period. But the point is that we came together, we've stood, we've hung together, and we're going to get a pretty good rule, I think, from the SEC in a matter of weeks here. And some of the impatience that I was alluding to earlier is with some of the companies grousing about how long it's going to take to begin to disclose possible conflict minerals supply chains. You know, we've been at this kind of work for a dozen years. Technical competencies have been developing. We should have confidence in them. Of course, it'll take time. But by God, there are urgent conflicts, not least in the DRC. And this kind of public policy cooperation among companies, NGOs, investors, in this case now, U.S. law, is the way to go. And I'd like to see even more such policy cooperation to deal with these very, very tough issues.
I'd like to address the very good question on using conflict zones. I think the best thing that business can do to reduce the role that youth potentially play in conflict is the creation of meaningful jobs. And I would put the emphasis on meaningful jobs, although I'm sure that cutting grass under certain circumstances is a very positive thing. But one of the things that we are learning is that the relationship between, or rather the role that youth play in conflict is a nuanced one. And while economic need is often a major motivator, there are other factors that matter too, namely the desire that youth have to have a positive impact in their communities, and the perhaps emotional need and social need to feel respected. And so the creation of a meaningful job is something that's key, and that could be either directly through the creation of jobs with that core business, or through local procurement policies, and therefore the creation of local jobs. The other thing that I would just mention is that I think that the provision of training or the development of alternative livelihoods is risky unless you are also providing those jobs. This is an intervention that has been done in many areas, and I think that we've come to realize that the youth involved in militant extremism or terrorism or many violent movements are not necessarily, in all contexts, the most poor. Sometimes they are frustrated, educated, middle-class youth. And so providing skills, but then not providing the opportunity to utilize those skills might actually make things worse.
Thank you very much to all our panelists. I think what we've done is we've scratched the surface of a very complex issue, and one that I believe will continue to deliberate in this particular venue and also in venues in the days and months ahead. But one thing that we could be sure, and I think all the panelists would agree, is that the days of claiming ignorance about the connectivity are behind us. I think looking ahead, the most important thing is trying to not just conceptualize, but also implement mechanisms that will make it second nature for businesses not just to be aware of the link between their activities and human rights in these fragile and challenging environments, but also about the necessity, and to some extent, as an earlier speaker said, make more of the business case for it. And so, on that note, once again, I'd like to thank the organizers for an excellent forum, and I ask you to join me in thanking our excellent panelists.